Cecilia has a problem. She cannot say no. Not to the extra shift when the other maid falls ill. Not to the desperate friend who needs covering. Not to one final glass of French champagne during the servants' celebration at Thornwick Hall. When the wine is good and the laughter is loud, and the whole world feels soft at the edges. And definitely not when the other maids dare her to flirt with the first gentleman she meets, because everyone knows sensible, careful, boring Cecilia would never. So when she stumbles into a set of chambers, warm fire, enormous bed, and the most beautiful shirt she has ever seen draped over a chair, she thinks. Actually, she stops thinking altogether. She changes into the shirt, she climbs into the bed, she falls deeply, completely, disastrously asleep. She wakes to a voice, cold, quiet, dangerous. Good morning? The man at the foot of the bed is the most powerful duke in England, and he is looking at her like she has personally ruined his evening. She should apologize. The champagne has other ideas. She smiles, and says the one thing a maid in a stolen shirt should never say to a duke. He laughs. Big mistake, because somewhere down the corridor, a desperate young woman has just realized that Cecilia's disaster might be the answer to all her prayers. She has one request, one impossible, catastrophic, completely unreasonable request. Make him hate you. Before the wedding, she was 21 years old, a housemaid at Thornwick Hall. She had small hands roughened from years of polish and cold water. She had a face that was pretty in a soft, forgettable way, or so she had always believed. She had a habit of knocking things over when she was nervous, tripping over her own feet when she was rushing, and apologizing so frequently that the other maids had started keeping count. She was, by every possible measure, unremarkable, and she was also, on this particular evening in the autumn of 1887, sitting in the warmth of the servants' kitchen at Thornwick Hall, laughing harder than she had laughed in months. Because the champagne fizzing in her borrowed glass had made the whole world feel softer, and the gossip flowing around the long wooden table had made every fear she carried feel very far away. The celebration had been earned. Lord Kensington had hosted a gathering of county families the week prior, and not a single piece of crystal had broken. Not a single dish had arrived cold. Not a single guest had complained, which, as Mrs. Fawley the housekeeper had declared with red-faced triumph, was nothing short of a miracle given that three of the upstairs maids were new. The kitchen boy had been ill for 2 days, and someone, she looked pointedly at Cecilia, had accidentally served the wrong wine at supper on the second night. But even that had worked out. Lord Pemberton had declared he preferred the Bordeaux, and nobody mentioned it again. So now they celebrated. Cook had allowed a crate of champagne, left over from the gathering, good French stuff, to be cracked open in the kitchen. The fire was roaring, the laughter was loud, and the stories about Duke Nathaniel Vaughan were getting more outrageous by the minute. He turned a viscount into a social ghost, said Mary, one of the upstairs maids, leaning forward with wide eyes. One sentence, that's all it took. He said something, nobody knows what, and the man hasn't been invited anywhere in London since. He dismissed a prospective bride after a single dance, said Polly from across the table. Didn't say a word to her family, just left. The next morning his solicitor sent a letter. He doesn't smile, added Thomas, one of the footmen, with the authority of someone who had read this in a newspaper. Not ever. There are people who have attended his dinner parties 3 times and never once seen his teeth. Cecilia took a sip of champagne. She had heard the name Duke Nathaniel Vaughan for the last 3 weeks. Ever since Lord Kensington announced that the Duke would be arriving at Thornwick Hall to finalize the details of his long-standing engagement to Lady Charlotte Kensington, Lord Kensington's eldest daughter, the entire household had operated under a low, constant hum of collective anxiety. Duke Nathaniel Vaughan was not merely wealthy. He was one of the most powerful men in England. He controlled land in 4 counties held interests in shipping and railway, and moved through Parliament with the kind of quiet authority that made other powerful men nervous. He had never, not once, behaved scandalously. He had never been publicly associated with a mistress, a debt, a gambling dispute, or a foolish wager. He existed in a category of person that England produced occasionally, and never quite knew what to do with, a man whose reputation was so immaculate that it frightened people. Perhaps, Cecilia said, setting her glass down with the careful precision of someone who was slightly less sober than she had been an hour ago, he is simply quiet. Has anyone considered that? Perhaps he is just a quiet man and everyone assumes the worst. The table went silent. Then everyone laughed. Cecilia, Mary said, you have had too much champagne. I have had precisely the right amount of champagne, Cecilia said, which made everyone laugh harder, because the empty bottle near her elbow suggested otherwise. She's gone bold, Polly declared. Look at her. One glass, and she's defending the Duke of Ravenscar. I'm not defending him. I'm suggesting we don't invent a monster when we haven't met the man. You know what? Mary pointed a finger. I dare you. First gentleman you see tonight, flirt with him, if you're so confident about men being misunderstood. Cecilia opened her mouth to say no. She had every intention of saying no. She was, after all, very good at no in theory. But then Mrs. Fawley appeared in the kitchen doorway, flushed and sharp-eyed, holding a tray of cut crystal glasses and a sealed bottle of very fine wine, and she said, Cecilia, again the East Wing has requested refreshments. Take these up immediately. East Corridor, third floor, the blue suite. And Cecilia, because she could not say no, took the tray. The champagne made the third floor staircases look remarkably similar. She climbed the wrong one. She took a left where she should have taken a right. She passed a portrait gallery she did not recognize, turned down a corridor hung with dark green drapes she had never seen before, and found herself standing in front of a door that looked, in the dim light of the single wall sconce, exactly like the door of the blue suite. She knocked softly, no answer. She knocked again, still nothing. She eased the door open. The room beyond was extraordinary. A fire burned high in the hearth, casting everything in amber and shadow. The ceiling was impossibly tall. The furniture was heavy and dark, mahogany and leather, all of it massive, all of it masculine. The bed against the far wall was enormous, hung with deep burgundy curtains, and beside it, draped over the back of a chair, lay clothes that the Duke's valet had clearly set out for mourning. A perfectly pressed shirt of fine white linen, dark trousers, a waistcoat. Cecilia set the tray down on a side table. She stood very still. The fire crackled. Outside, rain had begun. She could hear it against the tall windows, hard and cold, rattling the glass. She was wet from having crossed the courtyard earlier on an errand. Her dress was damp at the hem and shoulders. Her hair had come half loose from its pins. The room was warm, wonderfully, absurdly warm. The shirt on the chair was oversized and soft-looking and white as new paper. She should have left immediately. She knew that. Even through the champagne fog, she knew that perfectly well. But the fire was so warm and she was so cold, and the shirt was right there, and the room was empty, and she was so tired. Tired in the bone-deep way that comes from months of early mornings and late nights and never quite. Catching up, she made the first disastrous decision. She changed into the shirt. It fell to her thighs, sleeves rolled up past her elbows, soft against her skin in a way her own worn chemise had never been. She draped her damp uniform over the fire screen to dry, sat on the edge of the enormous bed. Just to rest, just for a moment, and then she lay back into pillows that smelled like cedarwood and something, clean and cool and entirely unfamiliar. She closed her eyes. She made the second disastrous decision. She fell asleep. She woke to light, pale gray autumn light filtering through half-drawn curtains, and the faint smell of coffee, and the sound of a fire burning low, and a voice, low and unhurried, saying, "Good morning." Cecilia's eyes flew open. She sat up so fast that the shirt fell entirely off one shoulder. A man sat across the room in the leather wingback chair near the window. He was fully dressed, dark coat, white cravat, every inch of him composed and deliberate. He held a cup of coffee in one hand. He was reading a letter, or he had been reading it. Now he was watching her. He was. And this was the first coherent thought her mind managed to produce. The most extraordinarily handsome man she had ever seen in her life. Not handsome in the easy, comfortable way of men she'd known. Handsome in a way that felt dangerous. Strong jaw. Dark hair. No longer than his collar. Eyes so dark they were nearly black. A stillness to him that was not the stillness of calm, but the stillness of immense, leashed control, the way a river was still at the surface while moving with enormous force beneath. He was watching her with an expression she could not read. She became aware, in one terrible rush, of precisely where she was, what she was wearing, whose shirt this was. "Aye," she began. "You are Lady Charlotte Kensington," he said. It was not a question. She opened her mouth. She closed it. He had never met Charlotte. Only miniature portraits and correspondence. She knew this. Everyone in the household knew this. Charlotte had been in France. He had been managing estates abroad. They had never once occupied the same room. He thought she was the woman he was supposed to marry. "You," Cecilia cast around desperately for words. "You are more handsome than everyone claimed." There was a pause. Then Duke Nathaniel Vaughan did something that, according to the entire English aristocracy, he never did. He laughed. Not a polite chuckle, not a contained, restrained exhale, a real laugh, brief but genuine, reaching his eyes, softening every hard line of his face into something startlingly, achingly human. Cecilia stared at him. He looked at her for a long moment after the laughter faded, and something shifted in his expression. Something that settled and sharpened and went, very quiet, the way a man's face changes when he has just seen something he did not expect and does not quite know what to do with it. "To Thornwick Hall," he said at last, with a faint, wondering note in his voice, as though greeting a strange new weather. The morning after was a disaster conducted in whispers. Cecilia slipped out of the chamber before the household was fully awake, her uniform still faintly damp, her heart pounding so hard she could feel it in her teeth. She made it to the servants' stairs, down two flights, through the back passage, and into the linen corridor before she stopped and pressed her back against the cold wall and breathed. He thought she was Charlotte. That was the terrible, burning center of everything. Duke Nathaniel Vaughan, the most powerful, most feared, most socially immaculate man in England, had spent the first minutes of his engagement meeting them sitting across from a maid wearing his shirt. She had to tell someone. She had to fix this immediately. She had to... Cecilia. The voice was low and furious and came from the shadow at the end of the corridor. Lady Charlotte Kensington was 23 years old, and she was beautiful in the way of women who had been beautiful so long they had grown entirely comfortable with it. Blonde, blue-eyed, graceful in a way that came from years of careful instruction. She was also, at this moment, gripping Cecilia's arm with a strength that was very much at odds with her delicate appearance. "Tell me," Charlotte said, through teeth that barely moved, "that you were not just leaving the Duke of Ravenscar's private chambers." Cecilia's mouth opened, closed. Charlotte pulled her further into the shadow of the corridor. "I saw you leave," Charlotte breathed. "I was up early. I saw you come down the east stairs, and I know those stairs. Cecilia, because they lead only to the guest suites on the third floor, and the only suite currently occupied is his." "It was an accident," Cecilia said in a very small voice. "I got lost. I took the wrong corridor. The room was empty. I thought it was empty. I only meant to set the refreshment tray down and..." "You were wearing his shirt." The silence stretched long and terrible. "I can explain," Cecilia said. You don't need to explain, Charlotte said. I need to think. That was the moment Cecilia should have insisted. Should have planted her feet and said, There is nothing to think about, my lady. I must go to the Duke and explain that there has been a misunderstanding, that I am not you, that I am the housemaid who delivered the wrong refreshments to the wrong room, and fell asleep in his very expensive linen. She should have said that. She didn't. Because Charlotte's face had done something very strange. The fury had drained out of it. Something raw had replaced it. Something young and frightened and desperate. And Charlotte pressed one hand briefly over her mouth, as though keeping something in, and when she looked up again, her eyes were bright with tears she refused to let fall. There is something you don't know, Charlotte said quietly. Something no one in this house knows. I need you to sit down. They sat in the small room where the house linens were stored, surrounded by stacked sheets and folded pillowcases and the smell of lavender and cedar. Charlotte Kensington told the truth. His name was Elliot Holloway, a painter, the son of a country solicitor. He had come to the village 3 summers ago to paint the countryside, and Charlotte had met him at a local exhibition her mother had dragged her to. He had argued with her about the light in a landscape, and she had argued back, and they had talked for 2 hours while her chaperone dozed in a corner chair. And by the time she left, she had known, with the quiet certainties of someone who has found the thing they did not know they were missing, that she was in love. They had corresponded for 3 years, carefully, through a trusted friend, in secret. The engagement to Duke Nathaniel Vaughan had been arranged when Charlotte was 16. Contracts between families, built on property lines and social alliance, sealed before Charlotte had any voice in the matter. She had never fought it openly. She had looked for quieter ways out. An illness that might delay things. A diplomatic excuse. A way to convince her father that the match was unsuitable without openly defying him. She had found nothing until now. I need time, Charlotte said. Elliot needs time. He has a commission, a significant one, and if it succeeds, he can establish himself. He can come to my father with something real. But I need more time before this engagement becomes permanent. Cecilia understood, slowly, where this was going. Her stomach dropped. Charlotte! He mistook you for me, Charlotte said quietly. He has never seen my face, not once. Only a miniature portrait, painted when I was 17 and wearing very different hair. He has no way of knowing you are not me. He will find out, Cecilia said. Immediately. The moment I open my mouth, the moment anyone in this house sees us together, not if we're careful. Charlotte. Cecilia pressed both hands flat on her knees. I am a maid, I know what you are. I don't know how to be a lady. I don't know how to speak to a duke. I don't know the etiquette, the posture, the everything that makes you you. I will give it away inside an hour. You already spoke to him for several minutes this morning, Charlotte said. And he didn't suspect a thing. Cecilia thought of the man in the wingback chair, the dark eyes, the laugh. I said one sentence, she said weakly, and it made him laugh. Charlotte's voice was quiet and wondering. My maid made the Duke of Ravenscar laugh. Do you understand how? She stopped, pressed her hands together. I am not asking you to marry him. I am asking for time. A few weeks. Long enough for Elliot to secure his commission. Long enough for me to have a real conversation with my father. Your father will notice I'm not you. My father is in London until the end of the month. My mother has a sick headache most of the day. The household staff I will manage. Charlotte leaned forward. You would not be alone, Cecilia. I will help you. I will tell you everything you need to know. I will make sure no one questions it. Cecilia looked at her. She looked at the fear behind Charlotte's careful composure. The desperate hope. The way her hands gripped each other in her lap. Tight enough to blanch the knuckles. She thought of every person she had ever been unable to say no to. She thought of how spectacularly that had always gone. And then, because she was Cecilia Roberts, and she had never learned how to look at someone drowning and walk away, she said. You have 3 weeks, not a day more. Charlotte let out a breath that seemed to come from somewhere very deep. There is one more thing, she said. Cecilia waited. You cannot simply spend 3 weeks pretending to be me and wait for the engagement to dissolve naturally. He needs to decide he doesn't want to marry me. He needs to choose not to proceed. Charlotte met her eyes. You need to make him hate you. The silence in the linen room was absolute. I need you, Charlotte said clearly, to be the worst possible version of a future duchess. I need you to be so unsuitable, so embarrassing, so utterly wrong for him that he withdraws on his own, without scandal, without a public breach, just a man who looks at his intended and decides the marriage cannot work. Cecilia stared at her. You want me, she said carefully, to spend 3 weeks with the most terrifying man in England, pretending to be you, while actively trying to make him despise me. Yes, and if he discovers the truth before then? He won't, and when the 3 weeks are over, and Elliot still doesn't have his commission, Charlotte's jaw tightened. He will have it. Cecilia looked up at the ceiling. The cedar and lavender smell of the linen room pressed around her. Somewhere above them, on the third floor, Duke Nathaniel Vaughan was beginning his morning, drinking his coffee, reading his correspondence, thinking, perhaps, about the strange girl who had woken in his shirt and told him he was handsomer than advertised. No, she thought, absolutely not. All right, she said. She saw him again at noon. Lord Kensington had arranged an informal luncheon for the family and their guest, small, private, just the immediate household. Cecilia had been dressed by Charlotte's lady's maid, a quiet woman called Agnes, who had been told only that Lady Charlotte wished to change her appearance slightly, and that questions were not welcome. Agnes had pinned Cecilia's dark hair into a style that was almost right, had laced her into a day dress of pale blue muslin that was almost a perfect fit, had regarded Cecilia's work-roughened hands with an expression of extreme professional suffering, and said nothing at all. Cecilia descended the main staircase of Thornwick Hall with the careful steps of a woman walking into battle. Duke Nathaniel Vaughan was already in the drawing room. He was standing near the tall windows that looked out over the garden, hands clasped behind, his back, posture so straight it might have been cut from stone. In the full light of day, he was somehow more striking than he had been this morning, and this morning had already been a great deal to manage. He wore black and grey, perfectly fitted. His face in profile was all clean, decisive lines, jaw, cheekbone, the line of his brow, and he held himself with the absolute stillness of a man entirely at ease with power. He turned when she entered. His gaze moved over her once, quick and thorough, and somehow both polite and entirely unreadable, and then he crossed the room toward her with quiet, measured strides and bowed. Lady Charlotte, he said, I hope the morning found you well. His voice, she noticed again, was lower than expected, unhurried, as though every word he chose had been considered before it was released. Very well, Your Grace, Cecilia said, with the precise degree of composure she had rehearsed on the stairs. And yourself? Better than yesterday, he said. There was something in his voice, the faintest edge of dry amusement, and when she looked up, his expression had not changed. But his eyes had. She felt heat climb her neck. I owe you an apology, she began carefully. For this morning, it was entirely... No apology is necessary, he said. I was told Thornwick Hall is a complex house. I am inclined to believe it. She looked at him. He was watching her with an expression that might, in someone less controlled, have been called curious. You expected, she said before she could stop herself. Someone different. A pause. I expected someone I had read about, he said. Correspondence is a particular form of unreality. The person who writes is never quite the person who speaks. Cecilia had written none of Charlotte's letters. She had no idea what they contained. And how, she said carefully. Do you find the difference? He was quiet for a moment, studying her. And then he said, with the same low, unhurried certainty, preferable. She had no idea what to do with that. Fortunately, the butler announced luncheon, and she was saved from having to figure it out. Lunch was a trial by etiquette. Cecilia knew which fork to use, broadly. She knew not to speak with food in her mouth. She knew to keep her voice low and her posture straight. These were things she had observed from the servant's side of the room for years. What she had not anticipated was how watching he was, not in an intrusive way, not obviously, but she kept catching his gaze across the table, calm, steady, taking notes on something she could not identify, and every time she fumbled something minor, took the wrong spoon, laughed too quickly at something Lord Kensington said, used her bread, to mop the last of the sauce rather than leaving it decorously. She saw something flicker in his expression, not disdain, amusement. It was extraordinarily unnerving. After lunch, when Lord Kensington was called away to speak with his steward, and Charlotte's mother had retired with a renewed sick headache, Cecilia found herself standing in the corridor with nowhere to escape to. Nathaniel fell into step beside her. I understand there are riding paths through the western estate, he said. I am told the views are notable. They are, she said, very. I wondered if you might be willing to show them to me tomorrow morning. She should have said no. She should have invented a prior engagement, a headache, a letter she had to write. She looked up at him instead, and the dark eyes were steady on her face, and she heard herself say, yes, of course. The corner of his mouth shifted, barely, imperceptibly, and he said, good. He walked away down the corridor. Cecilia stood very still in the hallway of Thornwick Hall and thought, this was a terrible idea. Then she thought, I said yes anyway. And then, most treacherously of all, she thought, I meant it. Charlotte listened to the report of the luncheon with the expression of someone receiving very bad news. He likes you, she said flatly. He was polite. Nathaniel Vaughan is not polite. He is either indifferent or interested, and indifference looks much colder than what you're describing. Charlotte paced the small sitting room they had retreated to. We need to begin immediately. Tomorrow. The riding excursion is perfect, actually. Plenty of opportunities to appear unsuitable. Charlotte, the man is not easily put off. He watched me use the wrong spoon at lunch and smiled. Then you need to do something larger than the wrong spoon. Charlotte stopped pacing. You need to be spoiled, demanding, shallow. You need to behave like the worst possible version of a future duchess. He is a man who values dignity above everything, so be undignified. He values composure, so be chaotic. He values... I know, Cecilia said quietly. I understand the assignment. She understood it perfectly. She simply already had the terrible feeling that it was not going to go the way Charlotte imagined. The riding excursion began well enough. Cecilia could ride adequately, competently, in the way of someone who had helped with the stable horses since childhood. What she could not do was ride well, and she had decided that this morning she was going to ride spectacularly badly. She demanded the most difficult horse in the stable. She announced, loudly, that she found the western path tedious, and would prefer something with better scenery, which meant doubling back past the area they had just ridden. She complained at some length about the quality of the morning light. Nathaniel listened to all of this. He did not respond with irritation. He requested the groom bring a different horse, a steadier one, which he suggested she might find more comfortable for the morning. He agreed that the eastern path had better light and turned his horse without comment. And when she, determined to escalate, kicked her horse forward too sharply, and nearly pitched sideways at the first gate. He was beside her in an instant, close enough that his knee brushed hers, one hand steadying the reins she had fumbled. Sit back, he said quietly, close to her ear. Weight in the heels, not the toe. His hand didn't linger. He moved back to his own horse immediately, but she felt the warmth of his nearness for the rest of the morning. She had not made him hate her. She had got a riding lesson. Attempt 2, rudeness. The evening of the second day brought a small gathering of local families, a dinner that Charlotte's mother had organized before taking to her rooms again. Cecilia arrived at the table, prepared to be difficult. She interrupted a conversation between Nathaniel and Lord Pemberton about railway investment to declare that she found finance deeply tedious, and could not understand why anyone voluntarily discussed it at dinner. Lord Pemberton spluttered. Nathaniel looked at her. "I agree," he said. "Most dinner table conversation about finance is theatre rather than substance. The real conversations happen in offices." He glanced at Lord Pemberton. "No offense intended." Lord Pemberton took some offense. Nathaniel, Cecilia noted, did not appear to notice. "What would you discuss at dinner?" he asked her, with that low, unhurried note, as though her answer mattered. She had not prepared for that. "Books," she said. The honest answer, arriving before she could stop it. "Or people. What people are really like beneath what they show." He was quiet for a moment. "That is," he said, "a considerably more interesting topic." He shifted his chair a fraction of an inch in her direction. Lord Pemberton was talking to the woman on his left. Nathaniel said, quietly enough for only her, "What are you, beneath what you show?" She looked at him. The candlelight was warm on his face, softening the strong lines, and his eyes were very dark and very direct, and giving nothing away while somehow asking everything. "I am not," she said carefully, very well practiced at pretending. Something moved in his expression. "I know," he said. She felt cold, but he had turned back to the table, and the conversation moved on, and she could not be certain what he meant. Attempt 3. Social disaster. The next afternoon, Charlotte was present at a formal tea with three county ladies and their daughters. Charlotte had coached Cecilia thoroughly. Cecilia had learned what not to do. She then proceeded to do it. She spilled tea, not a small graceful spill, a proper, spectacular spill that went across the white linen cloth and caught the edge of Lady Pembridge's sleeve. She then apologized so rapidly and thoroughly, and at such length that Lady Pembridge's expression shifted from offense to helpless amusement. She knocked a plate of finger sandwiches off the table, reaching for more napkins. She retrieved the sandwiches from the floor with such genuine, mortified horror that the youngest Miss Pembridge began to laugh, which made her mother laugh, which broke the tension entirely. Nathaniel was not at the tea, but he must have been told about it, because that evening, when she passed him in the corridor outside the library, he said, "I understand this afternoon's tea was eventful. I spilled on Lady Pembridge, I heard." There was that imperceptible twitch of the corner of his mouth. "She told my valet she hasn't laughed that hard in 3 years." Cecilia stared at him. "You are remarkably consistent," he said, with something that was not quite teasing and not quite warmth, but occupied some private territory between the two. "You make the room better by existing in it, regardless of what you knock over in the process." He walked away into the library. She stood in the corridor and thought, "This man is going to be the ruin of everything." Attempt 4. Insulting aristocratic tradition. Charlotte, upon hearing the full report of attempt 3, pressed her fingers to her temples and said, "Harder." Cecilia tried harder. At a family dinner 4 days into the visit, with the Kensingtons' cousins in attendance, she launched into a carefully prepared speech about the absurdity of arranged marriages. She was articulate. She was pointed. She was, she felt, quite compelling. Nathaniel was quiet through all of it. When she finished, slightly breathless, waiting for offense, he said, "I agree entirely." The table went silent. "The practice is antiquated," he said, in the same level, unhurried voice, as though he were commenting on the weather. "It treats human beings as items to be traded rather than people capable of judgment. I have never understood why it persists among families who claim to love their children. Cecilia looked at him. He looked back at her with an expression that was very steady and very calm and somehow very complicated all at once. Then why, said Charlotte's aunt, who had gone rather pink, are you here, Your Grace? Nathaniel was quiet for a beat. Because I gave my word, he said, and I honor my word, but I am willing to be persuaded. He looked at Cecilia when he said it. She did not know what to do with that either. Attempt 5, the library, Charlotte said. You need to be vapid. Brainless, he values intelligence. Take it away. Cecilia spent an evening in the Kensington Library, pretending not to have read anything. It lasted approximately 4 minutes. Nathaniel found her there. She had not expected him. He was looking for a particular atlas, and instead found her standing in front of the history, shelves with her hands behind her back, studiously not reading anything. What are you looking for? He asked. Nothing, she said. He looked at the shelves, then at her. You've read The Wilberforce. She followed his eyes to the volume she'd been unconsciously facing. The spine was slightly outward from where she'd touched it. I glanced at it. The pages are worn differently at the second and third chapters. Someone read those sections many times. He tilted his head. What did you think of his argument about social obligation? The fight was brief and valiant and entirely lost. She told him exactly what she thought about Wilberforce's argument about social obligation. She told him with more heat than was probably appropriate. She disagreed with one of his central claims, and she said so, and she explained why, and she was halfway through her third point before she remembered that she was supposed to be vapid. Nathaniel was watching her with an expression she had never seen on him before. Not the controlled watchfulness. Not the dry amusement. Something younger and lighter and almost wondering. You know, he said when she stopped, most people agree with whatever I say. I imagine that's tedious, she said. You have no idea, he said quietly. He sat down in the chair across from her. He stayed for 2 hours. Charlotte received the report of the library evening with an expression of absolute despair. He stayed for 2 hours? He asked good questions. Cecilia. Charlotte pinched the bridge of her nose. You are the worst saboteur in the history of England. I am trying. Are you? Charlotte looked at her very steadily. Because, from where I stand, it looks like you're having a rather lovely time in my library with a man you were supposed to be driving away. Cecilia opened her mouth, closed it. She could not, in honesty, deny that the library evening had been, in spite of everything, one of the nicest evenings she had spent in a very long time. Harder, Charlotte said again. The ball is in 12 days. We are running out of time. He began to look for her. That was the thing that Cecilia noticed first. Not in an obvious way, not in a way that anyone could have pointed to and named precisely, but she began to find him in places she had not expected to find him. Near the garden when she crossed it at 11, at the bottom of the main stairs when she came down from, when Charlotte came down from above. At the end of the library corridor, apparently absorbed in a newspaper, at the same time she, Charlotte, arrived there every other afternoon. He arranged his days in her direction. She knew this. She could see it clearly. And she also knew, with increasing certainty, what it meant. It meant she was failing the assignment. The riding lessons became a genuine routine. What had started as an excuse, she had announced, in her first sabotage attempt, that she adored riding, which meant he expected her to be capable on a horse. Which meant now, she needed to actually improve. Had become mornings. She caught herself looking forward to. He was a patient teacher, not in an indulgent way. He was precise and direct. Do this, not that, wait here, hands lower. He didn't praise unnecessarily, and he didn't soften corrections. But when she got something right, when her posture clicked into place, or she took a gait cleanly, he said so. Briefly, without fuss, with the same flat certainty he used for everything else. She found herself working harder in the mornings than she had ever worked for praise she'd been handed freely. One morning, 11 days into his visit, she cleared a narrow hedge line she had been trying for 3 days. She pulled up her horse and turned, laughing, real laughter, surprised out of her, and found him already watching her from 20 yards back, his horse still, his expression wearing something she had not seen before. Something quiet and private. Something that had nothing to do with the riding. He rode forward and said, "Well done." 2 words, the most ordinary possible words. She felt them settle somewhere in her chest, like something warm and permanent. That was the moment she understood she was in trouble. The fireplace conversations were worse. Charlotte had her mother's sitting room, separate from the main drawing room, and in the evenings when the household retired, Nathaniel sometimes appeared there. Formally, appropriately, with the door open and a housemaid visible in the corridor. Nothing improper, nothing that could be questioned, just conversation by a fire, in the dark, warm quiet of an autumn evening. He told her about his childhood on his 4th visit. Not the facts of it, not the titles and estates and public record. The truth of it. A father who valued precision and composure, and never once said that either of those things were expressions of love, rather than simply requirements. A house, Ravenscar Court, that was enormous and beautiful and almost entirely silent. Brothers who had died young. A mother who painted badly, in a room at the back of the house, and who had shown Nathaniel once, when he was very young, what color looked like when someone chose it freely, rather than because it was expected. She had died when he was 12. He told this without sentiment. But she heard, beneath the composed delivery, what the sentence actually contained. The specific, compound loneliness of a person who had learned very early that people left. Cecilia sat across the fireplace and thought about the girl she actually was. A housemaid, the daughter of a seamstress from Yorkshire, someone who had grown up in a 2-room cottage and learned to read from borrowed books. And she thought about how much she wanted to take his hand. She didn't. She was not supposed to be making him love her. She was supposed to be making him hate her. But the fireplace conversations had taken on a warmth she did not know how to stop, and she had begun to dread the moment when Charlotte's 3 weeks ran out and she had to leave them behind. She did not know he already knew. This was the truth that existed in the room alongside all the other truths, unknown to her. On the 8th day of his visit, Nathaniel had heard 2 maids talking in the garden below the window of the morning room while he was working at the desk inside. Their voices had carried up clearly on the still autumn air. Never seen Lady Charlotte so different. "Has she been in France too long?" "Mrs. Forley says she's been ill. Something to do with nerves." "Ill?" "She looked perfectly well at tea. Lady Charlotte never touched cake before. Never. She ate 3 of them." A pause. "She does look different, though, doesn't she?" Something about the hands. He had looked up from his papers. He had gone very still. Later that same day, he had seen her in the back corridor. The wrong corridor, the servants' corridor, where Lady Charlotte had absolutely no reason to be. She had been talking to the girl who blacked the boots. She had been helping her with a tangle of ribbon that had gotten caught on the brush. She had not seen him, and the expression on her face while she untangled the ribbon, careful, patient, warm, was not the expression of a woman performing kindness for an audience. He had gone back to his room. He had sat with what he knew for a very long time. Then he had gone to find her at the East Garden wall, where she arrived most mornings to look at the view, before the household was fully awake. And he had not said, "I know you are not Charlotte Kensington." He had said, "The light is good this morning," she had agreed. He had chosen, with full knowledge, to say nothing, because by the 8th day, it no longer mattered. She didn't learn this for a very long time. What she knew, by the end of the 3rd week, was that his days had organized themselves around her. She knew that when she arrived somewhere, he noticed before anyone spoke. She knew that when she laughed, really laughed, not the careful version she tried to use, something changed in his face, briefly and privately, before he brought it back under control. She also knew something that was considerably more inconvenient. She had started to feel, in his presence, the specific warmth of being seen, not seen the way the other maids were seen, as a uniform, a function, a pair of hands useful for particular tasks, seen as a person with opinions and specific thoughts, and a way of looking at the world that had value, seen in the way that only happens when someone is genuinely, quietly, unshowily paying attention. It was the most dangerous thing in the world. She knew it. She knew exactly how far below him she was. She knew that the moment the deception ended, she would go back to being a maid, and he would go back to being a duke. And the distance between them would be absolute and permanent and unbreachable. She knew this, and yet, on the 14th day of his visit, he said, "You are the best part of every day." They were standing in the garden. The light was almost gone. The air smelled of damp earth and late roses. She had said nothing for a full 3 minutes. She had been watching the first stars appear, because she liked them, because the sky above Thornwick Hall was very clear. And then his voice came, quiet and unhurried, as though he had been building toward it. She turned to look at him. His face was still, but his eyes, in the dimming light, were not. "Your Grace, I don't know," he said. And she heard something in his voice she had never heard before. Something slightly careful and slightly unguarded, as though he were making a concession he had been holding back for a long time. "Why, this visit has been different from everything I expected, but I know that it has been." She looked at him for a long moment. She thought about Charlotte, about Elliot, about the assignment that was running toward its end. "I should go in," she said. "Of course," he said. She turned and walked back toward the house, and she made herself not look back, which was how she missed him watching her go, with the expression of a man who has already made a decision and is simply waiting for the right moment to show it. 3 weeks had become four. She knew it. Charlotte knew it. Neither of them said it directly. Elliot's commission had hit a delay, something to do with the patron, a rescheduled viewing, and Charlotte had come to Cecilia with red-rimmed eyes, and a voice stretched thin and asked, "One more week, just one more." Cecilia had said yes, because she always said yes, but the weeks were costing her something she had not budgeted for. She missed him when he wasn't there. This was new. This was something she had no framework for. She had never missed anyone in quite this particular way before. The way that was not about company, exactly, but about a specific quality of attention. The way a room felt different when he was in it. Not safer, not warmer, sharper, somehow, more itself. Like a painting that only became a painting when the light was right. She began finding excuses to be in the places he was. She recognized what she was doing. She recognized it clearly, and continued doing it anyway, because she was apparently incapable of self-preservation when it came to Duke Nathaniel Vaughan. The jealousy appeared on the 16th day of his extended visit. Charlotte had a cousin, a young man called Victor Clark, who was staying at Thornwick for the weekend. He was handsome and easy in manner, and he sat beside Cecilia at dinner and talked with great animation about music and made her laugh 3 times. She did not notice Nathaniel watching. Victor did not notice Nathaniel watching. But Charlotte did, from across the table, and afterward she found Cecilia in the corridor and said, with a slightly alarmed expression, "The Duke watched Victor Clark for the entire dinner like a man calculating something uncomfortable." Cecilia frowned. "He's very composed." "He is not composed when he looks at Victor Clark looking at you," Charlotte said flatly. "He looks... what?" Charlotte paused. "Possessive," she said, in a very quiet, very controlled, very alarming way. Cecilia thought about this. She thought about it for too long, and the warmth that moved through her, When she thought about it was another piece of evidence, she added to the file marked, "This is getting out of hand." The near kiss happened on the 18th day. She had been walking back from the garden in the early evening, later than she intended, the path half dark and the air sharp with cold. She had heard footsteps behind her on the gravel and turned, expecting one of the footmen. Nathaniel was there. He had come from the stables, she could tell from the coat. He looked more himself in riding clothes than he ever did in the severe formal black of dinner. Less armored, more human, he fell into step beside her without explanation, as though they had arranged to walk together. As though this was something that simply happened, they walked in silence for a moment. "You're cold," he said. "I'm fine. You're shivering." She was, in fact, shivering, not entirely from cold. He stopped walking. She stopped because he did. They were in the narrow part of the path where the yew hedges grew close on either side, and the sky was a deep, fading blue above them. And in the silence between them, she could hear the distant sound of the house and the closer sound of her own heartbeat. He looked at her. The quality of his silence was different from other people's silence. It was not empty. It was full of something he was deciding whether to say or whether to do, or whether to cross the last careful distance that still existed between them. She looked up at him. He was very close. She was aware of every inch of distance, and of how small that distance had become. "Charlotte?" A door opened at the end of the path. One of the underfootmen, carrying a lamp, calling Charlotte's name for dinner. They stepped apart. The space between them reassembled itself. She turned and walked toward the house, and she concentrated very carefully on the gravel under her feet, and she did not look back, and she did not breathe properly for approximately 10 minutes afterward. Charlotte met her in the corridor. "I heard," Charlotte said quietly. "Nothing happened." "I know, something almost happened, which is different." Charlotte closed her eyes briefly. "Cecilia, I need one more week. Charlotte, one more week, I promise. I have a letter from Elliot. The commission review is the Tuesday after next. After that it's done, one way or another, and I will tell my father myself." She looked at Cecilia with something very raw. "I know I have asked too much already." Cecilia thought about the path and the fading blue sky and the almost closeness of a man she was not supposed to want. "One more week," she said, and went upstairs, and sat in the room that was not her room, and thought about all the ways she was in love with a man she was going to have to destroy. Charlotte's mother rallied. She had been ill for most of the visit, or performing illness, Cecilia had come to suspect, because illness was a useful excuse for withdrawing from social obligation. But the arrival of Lady Pemberton and the Countess of Hartfield at Thornwick Hall for what was billed as an informal gathering, but was clearly a small autumn ball, had brought her to her feet with remarkable speed. The house was transformed in 48 hours. Candles everywhere, flowers from the hothouses, white chrysanthemums and deep red dahlias and sprays of something pale and fragrant that Cecilia couldn't name. The ballroom was opened for the first time in a year, the chandeliers rehung with new crystal, the floors polished to a mirror finish. Charlotte supervised Cecilia's preparation with anxious precision. The gown was ivory silk, simple in structure but extraordinary in weight and quality. The kind of fabric that moved like water and caught light like a flame. Agnes dressed her hair with real skill, and Charlotte herself added a strand of pearls at her throat that had belonged to Charlotte's grandmother. When Cecilia looked at herself in the glass, she did not see herself. She saw, for the first time, something close to what Charlotte saw when she imagined a future she had never wanted. A woman made for ballrooms. A woman made for a life of silk and candlelight and fine dinner parties. It made her feel strangely sad. "You look beautiful," Charlotte said from behind her. "I look like a lie," Cecilia said quietly. Charlotte said nothing. He saw her the moment she entered the ballroom, She felt it before she saw it. The quality of attention shifting, the air in the room rearranging itself around a new point of focus. She turned and found him standing near the far windows, talking to Lord Kensington, and his gaze had moved from his host to her in the instant she appeared, and it did not move again. Around him, the room glittered and hummed, 3 dozen people in their finest clothes, the chandeliers blazing, the musicians tuning softly in the corner, all of it existing at a slight remove. As though the ballroom were a stage, and Nathaniel and Cecilia were the only people in it who were actually fully present, he crossed the room toward her. The crowd parted, not obviously, just the subtle rearrangement of people who understand instinctively that certain movement takes precedence. He stopped before her and bowed. "Lady Charlotte," he said, and then, very quietly, with only she close enough to hear, "You look remarkable. You've seen me in considerably less favorable conditions," she said, his mouth curved. "Yes," he said, "and you were remarkable then too." She felt the words land somewhere underneath all the silk and the pretense. "Will you dance?" he asked. The dance was slow. The musicians had chosen something old and formal, a waltz that demanded nearness, that made the distance between two people's bodies a matter of careful public negotiation. His hand was at her waist. Her hand was in his other hand at the edge of her glove. He was an extraordinary dancer. Smooth and precise and utterly confident, she understood, following him, that this was a man who did everything he did with full commitment or not at all. She concentrated on her steps. "You're counting," he said. "I'm not." "You are, slightly. Your lips move." She looked up at him, outraged, and found him watching her with that nearly invisible warmth that lived only in the corner of his expression. She was close enough to see it clearly now. Close enough that she could see the faint lines at the corners of his eyes and the way the candlelight caught the darker depths of his gaze. She stopped counting. She let him lead. The music moved them in wide, slow circles, and the rest of the room blurred at the edges, and she was aware only of his hand steady at her waist and his breath and the warm, grounding weight of being held by someone who held her like something worth keeping. "What are you thinking?" he asked. His voice was slow enough that only she could hear it under the music. "That this is the best possible version of an impossible evening," she said honestly. His hand at her waist shifted, barely fractionally, drawing her a breath closer. "Yes," he said. "Quiet. Certain. It is." The garden afterward was dark and silver under a full autumn moon. She had come out for air. He had followed, naturally, inevitably, as he had been following her for weeks, in the organized, deliberate way of a man who did not follow people without intention. The yew hedges formed a corridor of shadow. At the end of it, a stone bench and an old stone fountain, dry for the season, she sat. He sat beside her. Not close enough to alarm anyone who might appear, but close enough that she was very aware of the warmth of him, of the way the cold night air made that warmth feel more specific and more precious. "I want to tell you something," he said. She waited. "When I agreed to come to Thornwick Hall," he said, "I believed I was honoring an obligation, a contract made when we were both too young to have been consulted properly. I expected to behave correctly, to assess the suitability of an arrangement, to proceed or not proceed with appropriate composure." He was quiet for a moment. "I did not expect," he said, "to meet someone who made me feel that I had been living at the wrong temperature for years and had not noticed until now." Cecilia's hands were still in her lap. She could not speak. He turned and looked at her in the moonlight, the full weight of his gaze, undisguised for once, stripped of the controlled watchfulness. "I know this is not convention, does not account for," he stopped. He was, she realized, struggling with the words in a way she had never heard from him, and it was the most human thing she had ever witnessed in another person's face. "I am saying this poorly." "You are not," she managed. "I have completely ruined my peace," he said. I believe you have completely ruined my peace, and I find I don't want it back. The moonlight. The garden. The silk of the dress that was not hers. The strand of pearls at her throat that were not hers. The name she had worn for weeks, like a coat that belonged to someone else. She leaned forward slightly. He leaned forward slightly. The distance between them was a breath. Less. His hand came up, slowly, carefully, and his fingers brushed her jaw, turned her face the last small fraction toward him. He kissed her, soft at first, tentative in the way of someone who has waited a long time and is slightly afraid of having waited in vain. But she answered, she couldn't help it, and it stopped being tentative. It was not reckless. It was not sharp and burning. It was something more destructive, warm and earnest, and full of everything neither of them had said. And when she finally pulled back, slightly breathless, her hand was somehow pressed against his chest. And she could feel his heartbeat through the layers of coat and waistcoat. She looked at him. He looked back. "We should go in," she whispered. He said nothing, but his hand came up to cover hers against his chest, brief, deliberate. And then he released her and stood, and she could see in his face exactly what it cost him to let her go. She followed him inside, and on the other side of the ballroom, half hidden behind the door to the music room. Charlotte Kensington watched with wide eyes and a white face, and understood that everything had just gotten enormously messily, irreparably complicated. The morning after the ball, Charlotte appeared in Cecilia's room before sunrise. Her eyes were red. Her hands were shaking slightly. She was dressed, which meant she had not slept. "My father has returned early from London," she said. "He arrived late last night. He knows about Elliot. One of the servants, someone in town, I don't know. But he knows." Cecilia went very still. "He's called for a meeting with Nathaniel this morning. He wants the formal engagement announced by the end of the week. He wants everything finalized." The word finalized dropped into the room like a stone into still water. "Charlotte, Elliot will lose everything," Charlotte said. "If my father investigates, and he will, Elliot's commission falls through. His reputation in London is gone before it begins. He has no family money. He has nothing to protect him." Her voice was very controlled, in the way of a person using everything they have to stay composed. "I know I have asked too much already. I know you have. I know this has cost you things I didn't account for when I asked. But Cecilia, I am asking one last time, end it tonight, whatever it takes." Cecilia was quiet. She thought about the garden, the moonlight, his hand over hers. She thought about Charlotte, who had spent 3 years loving someone in secret. About Elliot Holloway, who had done nothing wrong except fall in love with a woman whose family considered him insufficient. She thought about how completely, thoroughly, devastatingly she had failed at every attempt to make Nathaniel hate her, and then she thought, "This time I cannot fail." "All right," she said. Her voice was steady. She was not. She found him in the library. He was at the window when she came in, turned at her footstep, and something moved in his face at the sight of her. The small, private recognition. The warmth that he no longer tried to hide in her presence. She forced herself to look at it, to really look at it. To understand exactly what she was about to destroy. "We need to speak," she said. He heard it in her voice. She saw him hear it. The faint change in his stillness. She sat across from him. "Last night," she began. "I don't regret last night," he said. "I do." The words were precise and clear, and she had made them so on purpose, and she watched them land and would have given everything she owned not to see what they did to his face. Nothing visible, that was the terrible part. He controlled it perfectly, but she saw in the single instant before control arrived what was beneath it. "I see," he said. "This whole visit," she said. And her voice was steady. She was making it steady. "I have been allowing something to develop that I should have stopped immediately. It was wrong of me. I should not have. The garden was a mistake. Charlotte, I am in love with someone else. She made herself hold his gaze. I have been for some time. One specific, he said. Yes, and this is not a convenient excuse. She did not flinch, no. Another silence, longer. The library was very quiet. The morning light was grey and flat through the tall windows. Then everything, he said, and his voice was absolutely level, and she could not hear anything in it at all. Between us has been what, precisely? A mistake, she said. On my part, I am sorry. The last two words came out slightly less steady than she intended. He stood. He did not raise his voice. He did not reach for anger. He looked at her for one long moment, with an expression she could not read at all, and then he said, very quietly, I appreciate your honesty. He walked out, and that was the most devastating thing he could have done. Be gracious. Be composed. Give her precisely the dignity she did not deserve. She sat in the empty library and pressed both hands over her face. She did not cry. She could not afford to cry. She had a job to do, and she had done it, and it was done now, and that was what she had agreed to, and she had always been very good at honoring her agreements. She sat in the library until she was certain she could walk through the house without her face giving anything away. Then she went to find Charlotte. He left Thornwick Hall the next morning. No announcement. No formal farewell. His carriage was brought around at 7 o'clock. She could hear it from the window of the room she should not have been in. And the household gathered briefly in the entry hall, and Lord Kensington shook his hand and said something, and then Duke Nathaniel Vaughan walked out of Thornwick Hall without looking back. Charlotte stood at the upstairs window and watched the carriage go. Cecilia stood in the corridor behind her and felt the specific cold of a house from which something warm has been permanently removed. It's done, Charlotte said softly. Yes, Cecilia said. Cecilia, don't. She kept her voice very even. Not right now, Charlotte was quiet. Cecilia went down to the servants' level, changed into her own uniform, picked up the morning supply lists, and began her work. She was Cecilia Roberts, housemaid. She had always been Cecilia Roberts, housemaid. Everything else had been a borrowed coat. She folded it up. She put it away. She worked. 3 weeks later, she discovered the truth. She was in the linen corridor, her own territory again, the stacked sheets and the lavender smell, the world that was actually hers, and she overheard two of the upstairs maids talking in the room next door. One of them was describing something she'd heard from a housemaid at the Pemberton estate, who had heard it from a groom who had been in the tavern with Nathaniel's valet on the night before the Duke left Thornwick Hall. The valet, apparently, had said, His Grace has known for weeks, since the second week. He knew she wasn't Lady Charlotte. Cecilia's hands stopped moving on the linen, he said. The valet said that the Duke found out and just kept going. Kept asking her to ride and talking to her in the library and all of it. Knew the whole time. Knew she was no lady. Then why didn't he say something? That's the thing, isn't it? Valet says he'd never seen His Grace like that before in his life. Says he was happy. And that whatever she was, he didn't want to stop. The maids moved on to other gossip. Cecilia stood in the linen corridor for a very long time. He had known. He had known since the second week. He had looked at her. Cecilia Roberts. The maid, the Yorkshire girl, with roughened hands and borrowed dresses, and he had known exactly what she was, and he had arranged his days around her anyway. He had sat with her by the fire, and taught her to ride and stayed 2 hours in the library, and kissed her in the moonlit garden. He had chosen her. Knowing the truth, he had chosen her, and she had looked him in the face, and told him she was in love with someone else. She sat down on the floor of the linen corridor, among the folded sheets and the lavender smell, and she pressed her hands over her face. This time, she cried, he had disappeared. Not quietly, not politely, he had withdrawn from society in a way that England noticed. Duke Nathaniel Vaughan, who had appeared reliably at Parliament, at club dinners, at country house parties, and London social gatherings for the past decade, had closed the doors of Ravenscar Court and stopped appearing anywhere at all. Invitations went unanswered. Letters received no reply. Parliament noted his absence. His solicitors managed his business affairs with no indication that their client was unwell. He was simply gone, present on paper, and vanished, in fact, in the way of a very powerful man who has withdrawn his presence from the world and made the world uncomfortably aware of the loss. Rumors circulated. He was ill. He was traveling. He had suffered some financial crisis. He had taken a mistress and was avoiding society's scrutiny. Nobody knew the real answer. Nobody except Cecilia Roberts, who was mopping a corridor at Thornwick Hall, with a heart made of something that felt like broken glass and shame in equal measure, and who knew exactly why he had gone. Charlotte had reconciled with her father. It had been brutal and honest and very long, and at the end of it, Lord Kensington had agreed. Reluctantly, with conditions, with a lengthy discussion of what exactly Elliot Holloway's prospects were and were not, to receive the painter. The commission had succeeded. The patron had bought 3 pieces. It was not a fortune, but it was a beginning, and it was real. Charlotte was, for the first time in years, genuinely happy. She found Cecilia one evening in the servant's garden, a small plot behind the kitchen block where the cook grew herbs, and sat beside her on the wooden bench without announcement. "You know," Charlotte said. "Yes. I'm sorry, Cecilia." "Don't be. You got what you needed." "That isn't." Charlotte stopped. Started again. "I knew after the library night that something real had happened. I told myself it didn't matter, because it couldn't be real anyway. You were a maid. He was a duke. The whole thing was impossible, regardless. I told myself that made it acceptable to push forward." Cecilia looked at the kitchen garden. The rosemary had gone woody. Someone should trim it. "I told myself," Charlotte said quietly, "that you would recover, and he would recover, and everyone would be fine. I think I needed to believe that because the alternative was admitting that I had used someone I care about as a weapon." A long pause. "He knew," Cecilia said finally. "I know he did. From the second week. He knew what I was, and he chose too." She stopped. The rosemary. The cold air. The sound of the house behind them. "He loved me. I think he actually—" She could not finish the sentence. Charlotte reached over and took her hand. "Go to him," she said. Cecilia was quiet. "Charlotte, you think it's impossible. I know. I spent 3 years thinking the same thing about Elliot, and what it got me was 3 years of secret letters and misery, when the answer was simply there in front of me, waiting to be chosen." Charlotte's grip on her hand was firm. "He knew you were a maid. He knew what it would mean. He chose you anyway. The only question is whether you're going to let the world's ideas about impossibility be louder than what you actually know." Cecilia stared at the rosemary. She thought about the linen corridor, the cold floor. The thing she had felt when she understood, finally, what he had done. Not just the sacrifice of his own surprise, but the deeper choice it represented. To see someone truly, and to want them anyway. To set aside every expectation he had been raised inside and choose a specific person instead of the world's idea of who that person should be. She had told him she loved someone else. She had told him everything between them was a mistake. And he had been gracious. He had been composed. He had said, "I appreciate your honesty," and walked away and closed the doors of Ravenscar Court. She had broken him, quietly, in the specific way that quiet men break. Not loudly, not visibly, not publicly, but deeply and alone. "I don't know if he'll see me," she said. "He will see you," Charlotte said with certainty. "That is not the man who vanishes and locks the door when the person he loves comes to find him." Cecilia looked at her. "How do you know?" "Because I have watched him," Charlotte said simply, "for weeks. At my own table, in my own drawing room, in the garden and the library, and at breakfast. I watched a man look at someone the way I look at Elliot, which is the way people only look at one person, ever, and I knew it for what it was. He is not over you. He is not going to be over you. She squeezed Cecilia's hand once. Go, she said. Ravenscar Court was 4 hours north of Thornwick Hall, on the edge of the moor. She arrived in borrowed travelling clothes, in a hired coach, on a Thursday afternoon in early November, when the moor was grey and vast and the sky pressed down low with the weight of coming rain. The house was immense, beautiful in the way of things built to last centuries. Stone walls gone silver-grey, tall windows, a long drive lined with bare-limbed trees. It sat at the centre of its landscape, like something that had been there always, and would be there always, indifferent to the smallness of individual lives moving through it. The butler, who answered the door, regarded her with the specific, expert blankness of a very well-trained servant, she said. I need to speak with His Grace. I don't have an appointment. My name is Cecilia Roberts. He knows who I am. The butler regarded her for a long moment. Then he said, Please wait in the hall. He came back in 7 minutes. His Grace will receive you in the study, he said. The study was at the back of the house. It looked out over the moor, a wide, low window with nothing in front of it but miles of open, rain-dark land. Books everywhere, a fire, a desk. He was standing at the window when she was shown in. He turned. The 7 weeks since she had last seen him had done something to him. Not age, not illness. Something quieter. A settling of the careful distance he kept between himself and the world, as though he had moved several more inches inside it and reinforced the walls. He looked at her the way she had looked at the moor from the carriage window, recognizing a landscape that was familiar and altered, both at once. Miss Roberts, he said. Not Lady Charlotte. Not the borrowed name, her real name. He had known all along, and now he was saying so, clearly, directly, and she understood, in that single moment, that this was not going to be simple. Yes, she said. That's yes. I'm sorry I let you say that name for so long. I'm not, he said. It told me things about your character that were more important than the name itself. The room was very quiet. Outside, the first rain was beginning. She could hear it against the window glass. You knew, she said. From the second week, yes, and you said nothing. No. Why? He was quiet for a moment. He had turned fully from the window. He was facing her now, arms loose at his sides, no desk between them, no formal furniture to mediate the conversation. She was very aware of the directness of him, the way there was nowhere to hide in a room with Nathaniel Vaughan. Because, he said, by the time I knew, I had already begun to prefer the version of events that included you. She swallowed. I was sent, she said. Be Lady Charlotte, to make you hate her before the wedding. Before your wedding. So that you would withdraw the engagement on your own terms, and she could be free to be with someone she loved. I know that too, he said. She blinked. How the housemaid in the garden, the ribbon. A very faint, almost smile. You are not a subtle woman, Cecilia. You are many extraordinary things, but subtle is not among them. She felt the warmth of his voice on her name, her actual name, her own name. I told you I loved someone else, she said. I lied. I said everything was a mistake. I said the garden was. I told you it wasn't real. I know that too. And you still. Yes, why? Her voice cracked slightly on the word. She hated it. She pressed forward. You knew I had deceived you for weeks. You knew I was. I am a maid. Nathaniel. I am a housemaid from Yorkshire. I have nothing. I am nobody that the world would look at and say, that is who the Duke of Ravenscar chose. I am so far beneath you that. Stop. The word was quiet, but absolute. He crossed the room toward her. He stopped a few feet away, not touching, but close enough that she could see every detail of his face. The dark eyes, the strong jaw. The thing that lived behind his stillness, that was not coldness at all, but its opposite. An enormous, banked, private warmth that he spent most of his life keeping very carefully controlled. The world, he said, has a great many opinions about who I should choose and what she should bring with her, and I have spent 34 years paying careful, respectful attention to those opinions. He paused. I find, he said, that I am done. Ah, she looked at him. I knew from the 8th day, he said. I knew you were a maid. I knew you were there to sabotage my engagement. I watched you try, and I watched every attempt backfire. Because you are incapable of being anything other than what you actually are, and what you actually are is... He stopped. Something in his face shifted, briefly unguarded, briefly young, briefly frightened. Cecilia, you made me laugh. In years. I had not laughed like that in years. You argued with me about Wilberforce and looked furious when I disagreed with you and spilled tea on Lady Pembridge and made her love you for it. You untangled ribbons for a housemaid in a servant's corridor when you were supposed to be a lady. You sat across a fireplace from me and listened to me talk about my mother as though so what I was saying mattered. He stepped forward. 1 inch. It was not convenient, he said quietly. I am aware of that. I am aware of exactly what this looks like to the world, and what it will cost you, and what people will say. I am asking you anyway. She looked at him. The rain was coming harder now against the study window. The moor outside was disappearing into grey and wet. The fire at the far wall was very warm. What are you asking? She said. He looked at her steadily. To begin, he said, honestly, with your actual name. Without the borrowed dress, or the assignment, or anything between us, except what is real. She thought about the linen corridor, and the lavender smell, and the floor she had sat on when she finally understood what she had destroyed. She thought about the dare in the kitchen. Flirt with the first gentleman you see. And how she had gone the wrong way up the wrong staircase, and opened the wrong door, and fallen asleep in the wrong shirt, and somehow, impossibly, accidentally found the right person. I spilled your champagne, she said. That first tray, the refreshments I was supposed to deliver to the actual guest. I left them in your room. I know, he said. I drank them. They were for someone else. Most things I value, he said, came to me originally intended for someone else. She closed the last distance between them. She took his face in both hands. Her real hands, the roughened hands, the maid's hands, and she pulled him down to her, and she kissed him. Not soft this time, not tentative. Something full and honest and long overdue, with all the weeks of pretending folded into it, and all the longing she had refused to call by its name, and his arms came around her, and he held her like something he had been afraid to lose, and had not yet fully believed he had found again. When she pulled back, they were both slightly breathless. I love you, she said simply, without decoration. He pressed his forehead to hers. I know, he said very quietly, I have known for rather longer than you have. Outside, the rain came down hard on the moors. The fire burned. The old stone walls of Ravenscar Court held the warmth in, the way they had held warmth for centuries, indifferent to rank and expectation, and the world's very strong opinions about who belonged inside them. He chose her publicly. This was the part that the society pages could not stop writing about for the better part of a year. It was not, as gossip required, a secret marriage. It was not a hasty scandal smoothed over with money and distance. It was, and this was the genuinely unprecedented element, entirely deliberate. Duke Nathaniel Vaughan, who had spent 34 years being the most correct, most composed, most impeccably respectable man in English society, chose a maid. Chose her openly, with full knowledge of what people would say. In the clear-eyed way, he did everything. He announced his intention to Lord Kensington in a letter so calm and precise that Lord Kensington reportedly read it 3 times before he believed what it contained. He announced it to his own family with the same composure, in a drawing room at Ravenscar Court, facing 3 relations who held very specific opinions about the Vaughan name and what it required. He said, "This is my choice, and I am not asking permission." Then he arranged it. There were people who were horrified. There were people, fewer than expected, because Nathaniel was a man whose approval had considerable weight. And his manner in the face of society's horror was so completely, serenely untroubled that it made horror feel rather embarrassing, who revised their opinions. Charlotte and Elliot Holloway attended the wedding, Charlotte in deep green silk, Elliot in a new coat bought with commission money, both of them wearing the slightly dazed expressions of people for whom things have worked out against reasonable expectations. Mrs. Forley, the housekeeper at Thornwick Hall, was heard to say that she had known from the beginning that Cecilia Roberts was going to cause extraordinary trouble, and she considered herself vindicated. The wedding was in spring. Thornwick's estate church, small and old, with white flowers on every pew, Nathaniel waiting at the end of the aisle, with an expression that was absolutely controlled and absolutely transparent to anyone who looked carefully, the expression of a man who is trying to manage the profound weight of relief. She walked toward him in ivory silk, her own this time, chosen by her, paid for with a generosity she was still, privately, learning to accept without guilt. And she thought about all the wrong turns that had led her here. The wrong staircase, the wrong corridor, the wrong door, the right shirt. She reached him. He took her hand. "You are late," he said. His voice was low and for her alone. 3 minutes. I am never late," she said. The world simply moved slowly on its axis this morning. The corner of his mouth shifted. The priest began. Years later, several years in the happy, uncountable way of time that has finally gotten it right, she would steal one of his shirts in the morning. Not because she needed it, not because she was cold, simply because she could. Because it was large and soft and smelled like cedar wood and him, and because she liked the expression on his face when he found her in it. Exasperated and entirely delighted in equal measure. "That is the third time this week," he said, in the doorway of their room at Ravenscar Court, watching her red in the window seat in his white linen, morning light on the moors behind her. "Evidence," she said, without looking up from her book, "that I have not changed." "No," he said. He crossed the room, sat beside her, took the book gently from her hands and set it aside. "You have not." He said it the way she had heard him say every important thing, quiet, unhurried, completely certain. She looked at him. He looked back. Outside, the moor was silver gold with morning. Inside, the fire was warm. And Cecilia Roberts, who had never learned to say no, who had climbed the wrong staircase and opened the wrong door and fallen asleep in a shirt that did not belong to her, leaned her head against the shoulder of the Duke of Ravenscar and thought that some mistakes were, quite possibly, the best things that had ever happened to her. And that is the story of the clumsy maid who woke in a duke's shirt and somehow ended up stealing his heart along with it. If this story kept you company today, give it a like. It means more than you know. Share it with someone who loves a good romance. And if you are new here, subscribe so you never miss the next one. Now tell me something. Where in the world are you watching from? Drop it in the comments. I read every single one. Until next time.